This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you need help bringing out the best in your pet, give us a call now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And among the calls, we have another special topic to share, Patricia.
That's right. You know, a lot of us have had collections for a time, right? Maybe you collected coins or stamps or have a few newspapers piling up in your living room. And that can be a lot of fun. But a little later in the show, we're going to talk about an extreme version of this tendency to hang on to things called hoarding. Animal hoarding can be a very serious problem, and we're going to talk about why people might do it.
And we'll also talk with an author and genetics professor to find out what DNA can tell us about evolution. But before we get to that, we have some callers waiting to talk to us, so let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
I'm Sarah from Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Sarah, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm really concerned about a behavior in our cat. She's about a year old, and she started chewing on electric cords.
Ooh. Oh, boy.
It's gotten so bad that she chewed all the way through two of our phone charger cords, and I don't know how to stop the behavior.
What have you tried so far?
Well, we've gotten some of the bitter apple, and that will probably work, but you have to reapply it every couple of days.
Yeah, so, you do.
And I can't take a chance that she'll even try it one more time because she could die.
You're right about bitter apple. Bitter apple only lasts for, it's relatively volatile, so it lasts, you know, 24 hours, 48 hours, so you have to reapply it. So one thing we might want to start doing is going backwards a little bit and trying to figure out why is she doing this? It is true that there are some cats get into these habits of chewing on either fabric. And that can be very serious because they can get intestinal impactions, obstructions. And some cats really love rubber. And we're not sure why. We know that rubber has a certain amount of oil in it, so that's one speculation. But if she's chewing on cords, that might be, sort of might fit into that category.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the small dog toys have a kind of a rubber that they, it's very hard for the animal to tear off pieces, and therefore it's less dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But it's soft enough that it's pliable. So go to a big pet store, go to a catalog, and look for either cat or small dog toys that have sort of a soft rubber feel that are safe for her.
Okay.
And you know, one thing that cats love, erasers.
Big
pink, you know, old-fashioned erasers. Some cats adore those. Now, make sure it's big enough that she's not going to get herself in trouble by ingesting some of it. But so that's what I do. I would, one, give her something that's appropriate and safe.
Uh-huh.
Two, I would keep up the bitter apple, and you might want to try something like a citrus oil because that's going to tend to last longer.
Okay.
I had a suggestion, and I don't know if this would work, but what about aluminum foil around the cord?
Had suggested that, but I'm afraid that she likes aluminum foil because she's had little balls of aluminum foil to play with, and she carries them around in her mouth, so I don't think that would work.
And if she did bite into the cord, wouldn't that make things even worse?
Yeah.
Possibly. But that might stop some cats. I would try the citrus oil, but at the same time, I think that third idea is really important, which is to create a remote correction so you actually set her up, have one cord that's not treated in some way, and set her up such that you're in the room watching her, except you're not really watching. She doesn't think you're watching her, so you have to be very, very subtle about all this. And when she starts to go towards the cord, you need to do something that's going to startle her and even scare her, given that this is life-threatening. Try those things and then take some aspirin for yourself.
Call us again.
And call us in the morning.
1-800-462-7413, our number to call. You know, Patricia, we received an interesting email from Robin in Juneau, Alaska, and she says that while traveling on her midlife crisis road trip number 2,
I love it.
She couldn't find our radio show, but she still had a burning question that she had to email us, and here's what she writes. I've been introduced to a man with a Great Pyrenees under the pretense that we're both dog lovers, outdoor people, that sort of thing. We went on a few walks with the dogs, and it was a disaster.
Uh-oh.
He's convinced that all Pyrenees run away, and there's nothing that can be done about it. That is simply their nature. He's had Pyrenees all his life. I've always had sporting breeds who I've shown and worked obedience on and who love to please me. The first time I met this guy, he had just arrived at a party completely drenched in sweat because he had chased his dog down the street after it escaped out an open door. I've raised my dogs like my child, good-natured, well-mannered, smart, and kind. This guy gets very offended if anyone even comes close to suggesting the dog may be taught to obey. This is a relationship that will not happen.
Doesn't sound like a good start.
But I still want to know, what is the true nature of a Pyrenees regarding its tendency to run away?
One of the phrases that peer breeders use for Pyrenees, there's a question. Larry, I'll ask Larry. Larry, what's the name of a Great Pyrenees who's off leash?
I don't know.
A disappear. So it is actually indeed true that of all the breeds out there, it's not just Pyrenees. There are certain breeds that are bred, unlike the sporting dogs that you're used to, that the emailer is used to. There are certain breeds of dogs that were bred to work absolutely independently of people. Beagles are one of them. Put a beagle in the woods and they smell a rabbit, it's very difficult to get that beagle to come back to you instantly right away, turn around in midair like a Labrador or a Border Collie. So on the one hand, he is absolutely right in that if of all the things to train a Pyrenees, the hardest thing to do is to teach them to stay right beside you and not take off for a brief period of time. On the other hand, can you train a Pyrenees? All kinds of things? Of course you can. Of course you can. 99.99% of the time when Tulip is outside, if I say, whoa, she stops. And if I say stay, she stays. And when I call her to come, she comes. She's a very polite dog. She knows all kinds of things. But training a Pyrenees is a very, very different procedure. Well, it's not a different procedure. It just takes a lot longer and a lot more effort than it does to train a sporting dog who is bred to work with you. So I get to say you're both right and get out of this mess, but I don't expect we'll be hearing about a lot more dates from this particular couple.
It does not sound like it. So you're both partially right, and you're probably also right in dumping him, Robin.
This is not a match made in heaven.
Thanks a lot for that email. And by the way, how do people email us?
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. Please send us an email. Send it to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to call, here's that number, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Yeah, hi, this is Paul from Garrett Park, Maryland.
Paul, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
So I've got a 5-year-old Border Collie mix, and she's the sweetest thing. She loves everybody. My ex-wife and I always say that she'd run off with the mailman without a backward glance. And you know, the less she knows you, the more she loves you. The problem is with other dogs. When I take her for a walk, she strains. She wants to meet the other dog. And before I knew what she would do, I'd let her go meet the dog. And she'd do the normal sniffing of various areas. And everything seemed fine. And the tail was wagging. Everything, all signs good. Then all of a sudden, she'd start to snarl a little bit, and then before you know it, the fur is flying, and she's going at it. And at first, I thought, well, it must be the other dogs because she's so sweet. But as this kept going, it became apparent that it was her. And I'm trying to figure out a way. This has basically banned me from the dog park.
Yeah, this is not her.
And I'm a newly single guy now, so it'd be nice to be able to get out and meet some women who love their dogs, and so this sort of precludes that. And here's the thing: is afterwards, she's fine, and in fact, she'll just sort of ignore the other dogs once she's gone through that. It's just sort of a blip. So what can I do?
Of all the people I've seen who have dog-dog aggression problems, I would say maybe 5% of them have this exact problem. And for people listening, it's so confusing when you have a dog like this because, for all intents and purposes, the dog is like, oh, there's a dog. Hi, 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 hi. And they give all the correct social signals. They do everything right. They go up to this other dog. Everything seems to be absolutely wonderful, even by people who are trained to look for the subtlest signs of tension. And then, wham, after about 2 to 3 seconds of sniffing, the problem dog becomes aggressive. And that's what I think, and I'm speculating, that's what I think. The key is I think it's related to smell. That's the only thing I can figure out after 18 years of doing this, is there's something about a an odor that, that the problem dog is picking up that creates this aggression. So what it is, I don't know. What is it? I don't know. But I will tell you what to do about it because I've had a lot of clients whose dogs were like this. A lot of people who listen to the show a lot have heard me talk about a watch me cue. Watch me or watch, which means to the dog, turn your head away from what you're doing, flip it around 180 degrees and look at my face. And it's a wonderful, wonderful way to get a dog out of the situation. Once you're there, what you do is you let the dog greet 1 second and then watch me, and you back away from the other dog. Good dog, good dog. You reinforce your dog, let him sniff again, watch me, pull him back again. So in other words, you avoid this buildup.
The 3 seconds.
2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds, bang, and then your dog goes. And you teach them to sniff, come away, sniff, come away. And you just start. It's really easy with a Border Collie cross. Usually it's pretty easy. You got a great treat or a ball, whatever the dog loves in your hand.
Tennis ball. She will be totally.
There you go. And you say, watch. And she turns her head and looks at your face and bang, you throw the ball behind you. Don't throw it towards in front of you. Throw it behind you.
Right.
Because the whole idea is to get her whip around 180 degrees. So first watch with no distractions. Then watch with distractions but not dog-related distractions.
Uh-huh.
Then start it with dogs who are friends of yours. Both dogs are on leash. And the dog is 50 yards away and then 20 yards away. And gradually you work your way up to getting closer and closer and closer. But you might want to hook up with a coach who could help you work through these steps.
Mm-hmm. Be a good idea.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And it's a tough one. Tough one to deal with sometimes.
Well, especially if he's a single guy and he's looking. This is not a good way to get dates, is have your dog attack woman's dog.
We got the email call from our question from Robin in Juneau, Alaska. Maybe could get together with Robin. Of course, it's a long way from Washington, D.C.
From Maryland to Alaska.
1-800-462-7413, our number to call. Coming up next, we'll examine the psychology of hoarding, why it's a problem, and how it can be treated. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's time for this week's topic, and Tricia, we've all heard about cases of hoarding where someone is found with maybe dozens of animals in their homes. Often they're in terrible condition, yet these owners claim to love their animals and believe they're taking good care of them. What's going on?
Well, you know, it's really an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? And we're starting to learn more about it. For example, Tufts University has actually initiated a consortium to study the problem. And there are neurobiologists in other places who are starting to unlock some of the keys to this behavior. And one of the things we've learned about it is that it appears to be on a continuum. It's basically an extreme occurrence of what's a pretty normal tendency to hang on to things. And most of us can relate to that. I don't know about you, but I have a few stacks of magazines in my living room that, you know, I just can't bring myself to toss out, right?
I have 55 or 60 duck decoys.
There you go. So collecting, there seems to be a predisposition in our species and actually in many animals to collect things. But hoarding is an extreme example of this, and it can, as you said, Larry, it can result in terrible suffering for animals and actually life-threatening conditions sometimes for the person who does the hoarding.
So what actually causes the behavior?
Well, you know, we're not exactly sure. There have been a variety of, actually some of them somewhat bizarre theories, but from dementia to some kind of delusional disorder to the bizarre one, which is not enough affection from your parents. I always love that we always go, let's blame
the
parents, right? But we are getting some evidence that this behavior is related to at least two things that are related to brain dysfunction. And one is there's abnormal processing of a very important neurotransmitter called dopamine, and there's a dysfunctional limbic system. That's one of the centers of the brain that mediates emotion.
Well, what can you tell us about dopamine? Why is that important?
Well, dopamine in the right quantity is a wonderful thing. It's the
That's what I thought.
It's the neurotransmitter related to feelings of joy and excitement. It's when you're infatuated, as you're running on dopamine. But when it gets out of hand, it can cause obsessive behavior. It can cause addictive behavior. And people who hoard animals and who hoard other things appear to have abnormally high levels of dopamine. But they also have a limbic system, an emotional center that doesn't seem to be working properly. They have an area of their brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is related to impulse control and emotions. That area of the brain is not working normally.
Well, it makes sense that hoarding things is somewhat similar to addiction, I guess. But how could it be that hoarders aren't aware when some of their animals are starving or even dying of this?
That really is the part that's just so hard to imagine. You know, they're surrounded by disease, starving animals, and yet they claim that their animals are in great condition. Well, you know, the fact is that our brains are they're just amazing things. And the downside of the incredible complexity and plasticity of our brain appears to be that we can also create our own reality. We're quite good at it. Some people's brains are actually able to completely ignore. They do not input into the consciousness visual evidence of suffering. They just replace it with another image. And, you know, that's not uncommon in some related disorders. Anorexics, for example, people who are literally starving and are profoundly thin will look in a mirror and see themselves as being fat.
Yeah. Is there any treatment out there for people who might suffer from this
hoarding business? The standard treatment, people have been trying medications that relate to obsessive compulsive disorder. And there are medications that are very helpful to that, but they don't seem to help people who hoard animals or other things. The most successful intervention so far has been what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a way of teaching people to analyze their thoughts and to manage them rather than just reflexively respond to them. Probably what's important for most of us who do not, thank heaven, suffer from this is to understand that people who hoard, they honestly feel like the things that they're collecting are part of them. And the idea of losing them creates this terrible, terrible feeling of terror and anxiety in them. And so, you know,
they need your help.
They do. The bottom line is that people who hoard animals or things, they have a physical affliction and they need our help and they need our support.
Interesting topic. Very interesting. Well, we have lots of interesting questions coming up, I will bet. So let's go back to the phones at 1-800-462-7413 and take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Lindsay and I'm in Eureka, California.
Hello, Lindsay. Thank you for calling.
I have a question for you. I have a 5-year-old male neutered Great Dane.
Okay.
And he was, I want to say, teased by young kids when he was at a very young age. It seems like he's still afraid of kids even now. And I just had a baby of my own. And he's not really wanting to accept my son.
Okay. How old is your son now?
He'll be 6 months in like a week.
Okay.
Or something like that. Now, I was gone, and my dog was at my parents' house, and my cousin was there, and he was 3 years old, and he poked my dog in the eye, and my dog actually nipped him.
Okay.
And I didn't see what happened. My mom said, though, that my dog did not give any warning. He just kind of nipped out. And I'm guessing this is from being teased.
Sure. And so there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that your dog has shown us that he has bite inhibition in that he could have bitten severely. I mean, obviously, if this dog had used anything, even 10% of the power of his jaws, he could have hurt this child very, very badly. And so I'm really glad to hear that the dog has good bite inhibition. That's the good news. The bad news is that you've already told me that your dog is avoiding your son already, and that's not a good sign. That's not a good sign at all. And you're right. It well might relate to having been teased by younger children or by children when he was younger. Dogs can learn to be afraid of kids. You know, kids don't know. I mean, it's one of the reasons why dog trainers and behaviorists were obsessive about managing children and dogs together because they can each learn the wrong thing. And so given that he has this history and given that we know he's acted on it, there are a couple things that are very, very important. One is I don't want that Dane to ever be in that position again. You know, we already know that he's uncomfortable with kids. He should never be in a position where a three-year-old could poke him in the eye or get anywhere near him, frankly. So part of what you need to do is manage things such that the dog and the child are always apart unless you are doing active training and conditioning. However, I have to say that the prognosis here, it's not great. It's possible that no matter how hard you work, you're never going to be able to create a situation in which your child is safe and your dog is happy. One of the saddest things that we behaviorists see are cases like this where as soon as the child is born, the dog becomes extremely unhappy. His whole life has changed. There are some dogs that cannot tolerate living with a young child. There are other dogs that can, so I don't want to be too negative here, but I do need to be realistic.
The other problem is here's somebody with a three-year-old at home trying to keep track of the three-year-old, you know, and your dog or your child, whatever the child's age, is very, very hard to do. So other alternative may be to...
It might be you have to start thinking about rehoming the Dane. And I know, I hate to say that. I think the hardest appointments I've had are sitting crying with people about talking about rehoming a dog they absolutely adore. But as Larry said, you cannot manage the behavior of a two-year-old or a one-and-a-half-year-old or a three-year-old. And you can't expect them to do anything but be a little kid. And that little kid's going to fall on the dog, going to poke his eye, going to pull his tail. So that's why I say you absolutely have to keep them separate. And don't fool yourself that because you're right there, you can stop it from happening. It's going to happen way faster than you can react to stop it. So you need to be really safe, be on prevention mode, and think about conditioning, but also talk to your family and think about whether rehoming might be the best thing.
Mm-hmm. Lots of tough decisions to make there, Lindsay. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And here's the number for you to call to join in, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Lee from Hartford, Wisconsin.
Hi, Lee. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I have a 2-year-old boxer female who just loves to go for car rides.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you open the back door, the first place she heads is for the garage. The problem is, as much as she likes to ride in a car, when I take her through a car wash, for instance, she will attempt to attack the brushes.
Oh, yeah.
So she sees these things coming at her, and I'm not sure if it's a fight-or-flight reaction or if it's a defensive thing, but it is quite a problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, now let me ask you this. How often do you take your dog through the car wash with your dog in the car? Do you wash your car a lot? You must wash your car a lot more than I do. You're a better car owner than I am.
I would say probably every couple, 3 weeks, something like that.
So here's the solution to your problem. And it's similar to what a physician told me once when I was trying to explain a particular pain I had in my leg. And I said, well, when I'm teaching a dog to work sheep and I walk backwards uphill, that's when it really hurts the most. And he looked at me like in a sitcom and he said, well, don't walk uphill backwards, like, you idiot. So here's my advice. Don't take your dog in the car when you get your car washed because it's a really common problem and you could maybe get it turned around in a year of extensive effort, but life is too short. Go teach your dog some fun tricks and spend your time doing something more fun.
This is only part of the problem, however.
There's more to the story.
Yes. She totally freaks out when I turn the windshield wipers on.
Oh, dear.
And if she goes car riding, inevitably, someday we're going to have the windshield washer, windshield wiper problem.
You're right. That is not a problem you can avoid since she loves car rides and it does rain on occasion. Have you considered is she loose in the car? Let me ask you that.
Yes.
Okay. You know what I do is I would teach her to be comfortable in either the back of the car with one of those grate-like dividers or teach her to be in a crate or have her in a seatbelt. You know, it is is very dangerous for dogs to be loose in the car. So I would consider teaching her to be comfortable in a crate, or else just having one of those dividers that you can buy easily at any pet store or good catalog. Go online, you can find one easily. And it will keep her from going forward and attacking the windshield. And if she's far away and she's still sort of barking and lunging at it, then you can do a little bit of training. You can teach her when the windshield wipers come on. If she sits, she'll get a really great treat. So it's got to be a great treat because she probably loves going after the windshield wipers.
Okay. Thanks, Lee. Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, find out what DNA can tell us about evolution and discover what our DNA has in common with others in the animal kingdom. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers online archives of the show, pet tips contributed by other listeners, and a complete list of guests featured on the program. Our website is callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Also, the radio store provides a selection of books and training guides featuring advice to deal with multi-dog households and leaving pets home alone. Information and ordering at 800-747-7444. That's 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week we welcome Sean Carroll to the program. Sean is an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and professor of genetics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And his latest book is The Making of the Fittest, DNA and the Ultimate Forensic Record of Evolution. And he joins us in the studio to talk about it. Sean, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
How does DNA provide us with a comprehensive record of evolution?
Well, it's a very information-rich document. And so in addition to containing the instructions for making an individual and all of its body parts and all of its cell types, it also contains a record of where that individual has come from in the course of evolution, its closest relatives, its most distant relatives, how genes have changed over the course of time as it's adapted to different habitats. So this record gives us a very detailed look at how organisms have adapted and their history of how their lifestyles are different from those of their ancestors.
Hmm. You know, you talk about a particular kind of genes. You talk about immortal genes and fossil genes. Could you tell us about those genes and what they tell us about a species?
Sure. So immortal genes, I refer to this group of genes that have been around really as long as cellular life has existed, probably about 3 billion years.
Wow.
These are genes found in every type of organism on the planet, from the bacteria that live at high temperatures in Yellowstone to ourselves. And these genes are so old, and they are so critical to life, that they have remained largely unchanged in function and in their DNA code for 3 billion years. So they are probably the oldest thread we can find uniting all forms of life together. Fossil genes are an altogether different thing. Fossil genes are genes that used to work, but no longer do. They're relics in our genome, relics of past lifestyles, relics of things that we and other species used to do, but no longer do. And we can see them because the DNA code doesn't degenerate too quickly. But nonetheless, these are really baggage we're carrying around that contributes nothing to our body function.
You know, one of the neat things in the book you talk about is the ice fish. What are ice fish and why are they such a good example of successful adaptation to an environment?
Well, ice fish, and let's keep this clear from ice fishing, which is a whole together different
right.
thing. So ice fish, I think, is about the most remarkable animals I know of. They live in the near the Antarctic in the Southern Ocean, and they are the only animals with backbones that do not have red blood cells. So everything else for the last 500 million years, all other fish, all reptiles, all birds, all mammals have red blood cells that carry oxygen around their bodies. Well, the ice fish have discarded this way of life. And the reason why they've discarded this way of life is pretty much the same rationale of all the things we go through to keep our cars running in a cold winter. Those red blood cells would make the blood fairly thick. And in cold water, and this ice fish lives in water that's a few degrees below the freezing temperature of fresh water. So it lives at about 30 degrees Fahrenheit, very cold ocean. That water would make its blood fairly viscous. And so it has junked this red blood cell lifestyle. It has very dilute blood and has a large heart for just pumping around this very dilute fluid around its capillaries. A really strange adaptation. It has made a whole bunch of other adaptations, though, too. This fish lives in close proximity to ice floes and to sea ice. And it's because its tissues are full of water, if it were to contact that ice and it have no protective mechanism, it would freeze like a fish stick, right? Just glob right to it.
Great metaphor.
So its bloodstream and tissues are full of a really peculiar family of proteins that are antifreezes. They prevent ice crystal formation inside the tissues and around various organs. And so that enables this fish, again, to live in this very extreme environment. And there's all sorts of other signatures in its physiology and in its DNA of how this animal has adapted to such an extreme habitat. And that's why I emphasize it so much in the book of as how the DNA record can tell us about the history of adaptation, because all over this organism's DNA are signs of how it has had to change to exploit this habitat that other fish were not able to.
Can I ask you a question about this particular fish? You talk about them. It sounds as though they evolved from standard vertebrate fish, and they had red blood cells, and now they've evolved to adapt to their environment, got rid of the red blood cells that causes their blood to be so slow and sticky. But how do they get oxygen to their tissues then?
Well, the concentration of oxygen in their bloodstream is the same concentration of oxygen in the seawater around them. They are really just taking in oxygen passively through their gills and through, they have pretty much a scaleless skin and enlarged capillaries. So it's really just coming in by diffusion across their skin. And their bloodstream is not enriched in oxygen, so they have no active way of holding on to oxygen and delivering it to tissues when it's needed. So they've made some great compromises in adapting to this lifestyle. And we know they were, at one time, red-blooded. In other words, their ancestors were red-blooded because they still have pieces of the genes that are critical for carrying oxygen in their DNA, some of these fossil genes as well. So that DNA record tells us a lot about how these animals have adapted to that cold temperature.
And we don't know how long it took them to evolve, but I think in your book you talk about the fact that evolution doesn't necessarily take a long time to occur. Talk about that, I think you call it evolutionary arms race that takes place between certain species.
Well, evolution, really the pace of evolution is sort of determined more by the intensity of the competition than by anything going on genetically. What happens in terms of DNA and mutations and the random variations that arise, well, there's plenty of that going on all the time. But when animals get locked in an arms race, or maybe a parasite and a host get locked in an arms race, evolution can move very quickly. I think one example I give in the book, again, it sort of has perhaps not such a humorous anecdote attached to it. Out in the Northwest, there's a very toxic newt. And this newt is in an arms race with garter snakes that feed on it. And the newt has, over fairly recent time, become increasingly toxic as the garter snakes become increasingly resistant. So if the garter snakes are feeding on the newt, then only the more resistant garter snakes survive and produce offspring. And if the newt's becoming more toxic, only the more toxic newts are escaping predation by the garter snakes. So these animals are locked in an arms race. And the story I tell is of a young man who, at a drinking party, swallowed one of these newts.
No.
Oh.
And it's a documented case of fatal poisoning by this newt.
Newt poisoning.
Newt poisoning. I nominate him in the book for one of those Darwin Awards because he took his own genes out of the gene pool. But the reason why the animal is so preposterously toxic and could kill a full-grown adult male is it's been locked in this race with garter snakes. So it has far more poison that could kill any other predator easily. But these garter snakes are so resistant. And we see this a lot. We've been locked in an arms race with parasites like malaria, and probably no other parasite has left such a strong signature on the human DNA record as malaria. And it's affected the evolution of many, many genes and a lot of our red blood cell physiology. And so evolution sort of works in fast forward, and you can see the malarial parasites evolving and humans are evolving in response to that. And that really dictates the pace of evolution.
How much does our DNA have in common with that of other living things?
Well, if you're just considering sort of going letter by letter and ignoring sort of missing bits and some inserted bits, with chimpanzees, we're about 98.94%, give or take, identical. So about 1 out of 100 letters of our DNA code and of the chimpanzee's DNA code differs from each other. As you go to less related animals, say to other mammals, that percentage starts to drop off, but it's still very substantial. If you were to look at the mouse DNA record, most genes in a mouse can be aligned with the genes of a human, including large blocks of our chromosomes. So, and we have very, very similar numbers of genes as every other mammal. So while some people might think humans would be, you know, top of the chain and have more genes than anything, turns out we don't have more genes than any of our pets. We don't even have more genes than a puffer fish. So we're going to have to get used to that, I guess. Evolution is also remarkably conservative in terms of keeping around things that have worked for a long span of time. So it's this interplay of conservation of things that work and experimentation and novelty that evolutionary biologists are trying to now trace through the DNA record.
And it sounds as though our recent advances in understanding DNA and analyzing it have had a profound effect on our understanding of evolution.
Absolutely. It's a new golden era in evolutionary science, because every change in a trait, whether that's digestion or vision or the form of a body part or something like that, all that involves changes in DNA. Well, until recently, we didn't have a systematic way to trace all those. It's really just like the forensic work you sort of see on TV. Reading through the DNA record takes a bit of detective work. Well, now with these, what you've probably heard of, the genome projects, it's not just the human genome project. We have about 800 species where we have the complete or nearly complete DNA sequence, and this number is growing every day. So we're doing that detective work now, but we have massive amount of data relative to what we used to have. One comparison is if you went 20 years ago when we still were able to sequence DNA 20 years ago, but not on the industrial scale we do now. If you were to type out all the DNA code we had 20 years ago, the little letters A, C, G, T, G, G, T, T, all that, it would fill about the size of an average novel. Now, if you were to type out all the DNA record that we have and fill novels and stack those novels, it'd be 4 times the height of the Sears Tower. So evolutionary biologists are combing through those novels for all the stories of how various species have evolved on the planet.
And that's going to help us.
It's going to help us in lots of ways. Certainly, as we understand our close relationships with other animals in the kingdom, we're appreciating how much we have to learn about our own biology and physiology from other animals. In all aspects, whether that's aspects of animal husbandry, animal breeding, whether that's dogs or horses or cattle or anything like that, the DNA record is really important to understanding how we can improve these things for human uses. Same on the plant side. Absolutely crucial on the side of medicine in terms of understanding the fungal parasites, pathogens, bacterial pathogens, how viruses evolve, etc. I mean, we are part of nature, and we have been battling these things for as long as we've existed on the planet. And by having a full record of how they work, we can design better approaches to manage them to our benefit.
Sean, a real pleasure. Thank you for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Carroll is the author of The Making of the Fittest, DNA and the Ultimate Forensic Record of Evolution. He joined us today from our studios at Wisconsin Public Radio. Don't go away. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, with your chance to win a copy of Sean's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
This is Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. On last week's show, we featured caribou, and we asked, how fast can the average caribou run? And Patricia, what's the answer to that trivia question?
50 miles an hour is how fast the average caribou can run. If you think about that, 50 miles an hour?
That's fast.
That's a lot. These animals, some of them migrate actually more than 3,000 miles each year. That's farther than any other land mammal. 3,000 miles, that's amazing. Yeah. And they have all these adaptations. They have concave hooves that make it easy for them to travel across snow. They sort of act like paddles. They almost look like paddles. Mm-hmm. Helps them when they need to swim. They have hollow hair that helps keep them warm throughout this long migration. But you know what also helps them float when they're moving across large lakes and rivers?
So 50 miles an hour.
Pretty fast.
They have to slow down when they get to school zones.
Right.
We want to congratulate our four winners. They each won a copy of Carsten Heuer's book, Being Caribou. And this week we're ready to ask another trivia question. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pulled together, and two lucky winners will be selected at random to win a copy of The Making of the Fittest by Sean Carroll. And here's today's question. In The Making of the Fittest, Sean Carroll talks about the colobus monkey, and the colobus monkey is special for a number of reasons. For one, it has full color vision, so it can find nutritious leaves in the forest. It also has a stomach with multiple chambers to help digest those leaves. But another reason the colobus monkey is special is because it's the only monkey that doesn't have a certain body part that's special to all primates. What body part is this? You think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413 and check out our website in about a week to find out the answer. We'll have it posted at callingallpets.org. And for now, we're ready to take some more calls. So let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Karen, and I'm calling from Boise, Idaho, and I think I have a fairly unique cat problem. My cat, Annabelle, who is about 5 years old, has developed a habit of breaking up the feces in her cat box and then scooping them out and playing hockey.
Oh, my.
With them. And I, you know, this is, you know, as you can well imagine, a pretty disturbing habit to have developed. And I have identified it as probably a jealousy problem because I have been letting one of the outside cats that I feed come in for short periods of time when it's very cold. And I noticed that this behavior started shortly after I was allowing this other cat to come in. However, even when the other cat goes outside, this behavior continues. So I would like to find some options to deal with this because there's no way I would never give her to someone else and watch her behave. You know, and nor will I ever do anything other than keep her. So I would like to learn to live with her.
Sure, with this bizarre, not particularly tasteful habit.
Poop pucks.
Well, Larry sort of summed it up there as a hockey fan. So I'll tell you, here's what I think is going on. I don't think it's jealousy, although I'm not somebody who argues that animals can't be jealous. I actually think they can be, but I don't think that's true in this case. I think it relates more to stress and arousal level. You know, a lot of animals, a lot of humans, when we get a little nervous, a little anxious, a little agitated about something, we find all kinds of coping mechanisms. We find all kinds of things to do. And very often we're not even conscious of them. We don't plan to do them. We just start doing them. And I think that's probably what's happening with this kitty. Remember, if it started when another cat started coming inside, even if that cat is outside, the house still smells like that cat. And cats are all about smell. And if they're scenting the smell of another cat in the house, then she's still your cat is still responding to that other cat's presence, whether the cat is there or not. So that well might have been a precipitating factor. But now that she does it when you come back from trips, it might be this is sort of a release from her anxiety. So I think the best way to deal with it is one, first of all, just logistically, mechanically, there's some cat boxes that are actually self-cleaning cat boxes. And what happens is after the cat uses it and the cat leaves the box, there's this little motorized magic that occurs, and the solids are shifted into a tray underneath. So that's something you might want to think about. Some cats don't like them. They're covered. But some cats have no problem with them whatsoever. So that would basically store the cat's urine and feces in an area she couldn't get to. So that's one possibility. The other thing I would do is when you're there is I would entrain a new habit. So when she goes to the bathroom, if you can manage to predict when she might go, most cats are pretty regular, sort of like people, like
sure.
dogs. And so you might be able to predict when she's going. And if you follow her in, and as soon as she's done going to the bathroom, I want you to get her attention elsewhere, throw her a toy, give her something else to play hockey with. So you're going to encourage her to play hockey with little crumpled up cellophane or tinfoil or something like that. A lot of cats love to bat things around with their paws. So encourage her to do that. Just encourage her to do that with other objects. Then the third thing you might want to think about is if this is indeed related to that other cat, I want you to think about how important is it to let this cat come in and out of my home? Is this really a second cat? Is it really important? And if it is, then you might want to think about trying to help your resident cat deal with anxiety related to that. Don't force interactions. You might want to think about feel away, that plug-in, or spray on pheromone that can relax some cats. That's another possibility. So those are some ideas to get you started anyway.
And Karen, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. I like that litter box that sort of motors.
Yeah, the magic disappearing feces box.
You know, Jeremy from Logan, Utah, sent us a pet tip. He also had a cat that couldn't help but scoop litter and other little presents out of the litter box. And so here's what he says. Our cat's over-digging in the litter box sent litter everywhere, and of course the smell was never a treat. What I did was buy one of those deep storage bins. I bought the smallest one they sold, 3 to 5 gallons in volume, and I filled it with kitty litter. Then I took the lid, cut the middle out of it, and put the lid back onto the storage bin. The hole in the lid was large enough to allow my cat into the box, but covered the edges such that he couldn't scoop or kick litter out of the box. My cat took to the new litter box immediately. Now the litter stays in the box, and what's more, my poodle can't get into the box
Ooh.
To eat the cat's leavings.
Ooh, that must be a big poodle. But I think that's a really great idea. The cautions I might have about that is if you have a cat who is in any way a little hesitant about the litter box, I don't want you to have this cover put your cat off. So mm-hmm. you might want to start with, they're not very expensive, so buy a couple of extra covers if you can and cut a very big hole on the inside, and then you can make the hole a little smaller and a little smaller once the cat gets used to walking across the cover. That's the one thing I'd be a little worried about with some cats. Some cats don't, I think even cat boxes without covers for some of them are not large enough. Mm-hmm. So that's the one thing I'd think about. But, you know, a lot of us, luckily, have cats who are so amenable to all kinds of different bathrooms, basically.
And our listeners are ingenious sometimes in coming up with solutions.
Extremely ingenious. And if you're ingenious or just have a question or a tip for anybody, please send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join in with a question for us here on air, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi. This is Julia from Stoughton, Wisconsin.
Julia, thank you very much for calling.
No problem.
What's on your mind?
Well, I am extremely allergic to cats. I grew up with a dog without any allergy symptoms whatsoever, so I always thought I was not allergic to dogs. I have not had a dog for over 20 years. I would love to have a dog, but I've noticed recently when I'm around dogs, like my friend's dogs, that I'm showing allergy signs.
Mm.
And I have a 2-year-old, and I really would like to know what breeds of dogs I should be considering given these recent changes in my allergies, and I would also would like a kid-friendly dog.
Sure. There are a couple of breeds that do seem to cause fewer problems than others. There is no magic dog out there, however, unless you find some of the hairless dogs who do not cause any kind of allergy symptoms. It's really a matter of a continuum. But the dogs that do best seem to be the breeds that have the soft, furry. Basically, they have the undercoat is basically forms the base of their fur. They don't have that straight overcoat that dogs who like, if you're petting a German Shepherd or a Husky, the hair you're actually petting is the overcoat. And then the stuff that comes out in spring in huge handfuls is the downy undercoat. And so there's some breeds of dogs, some poodles, for example, Wheaton Terriers are famous. For example, Bichon Frisés are another example that are famous for we've selected for a lot of that undercoat and not many of the top guard hairs. And it's the guard hairs that tend to hold the saliva that actually holds the protein that usually causes the allergy. So that's one thing you want to think about. I would definitely go to an allergist without question. I'm allergic to dogs and cats. I actually got shots when I was a young child. My mother, bless her heart, put me on the bus twice a week, and I got shots. And it's helped me profoundly. I'm much more allergic to cats than I am to dogs, which is very common, by the way. Mm. But so certainly I think you'd be very wise to go to an allergist. But then you might want to check out some of these undercoated fluffy breeds.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, Patricia, there's thinking back to Sean Carroll and his book, there's something in my genetic code that is telling me that it's time to say thank you to you for being here today and for giving me some more great education.
Those genes have clearly been selected out by our producer.
Thank you for listening, by the way. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0105P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.